1, 2, 3, come! Ranking the Beatles' music is the reason for this show. And if you listen to it, you might think that my rankings blow. All of the other podcasts. I don't know. That's all I got. That's as far as I got. I thought that was pretty good, though.
I like it.
A Yuletide holiday jam. Welcome, everybody. This show comes out right before the Christmas holidays.
Ooh.
So if you celebrate Christmas, we wish you a happy happy Christmas. If you celebrate the other holidays, of which there are many.
So many.
Happy holidays to all of you.
Yes.
From all of us here at Ranking the Beatles. Welcome to episode 119. I am Jonathan, over here on the left. As always, the lovely, the boisterous, the exuberant, the jubilant. Julia, how are you, my love?
I'm all of those things.
Yes, today, of course, all of those things.
I like it.
Good.
How are you?
I'm good. We only got two more
for the year.
Yeah, we've done a whole bunch this year. It's been a whole lot of fun.
We have. We're in the top 100. It's very exciting.
We are. My gosh, we are ranking 96 today. Oh my goodness. We're doing it, baby. We're working. We're chugging along.
Woof. Can we do some episodes where it's like five songs
to speed this process along? That would take forever.
Just doing a bridge.
I don't want to do that. That's just too much. Nah. We got to give the people what they want.
The songs are good. Moving on.
We got to give them what they want. But I'm excited about this week's episode, y'all. Our guest today is a music critic. Our guest today is the music and culture critic at Salon and the host of the Everything Fab Four podcast. He's a Beatles author who's written a number of books on the band, including Solid State, The Story of Abbey Road and the End of the Beatles, and John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life. He's also the co-author of All Things Must Pass, Harrison Clapton and Other Assorted Love Songs with our buddy Jason Krupa, who hosts the fantastic Producing the Beatles podcast that our guest and I were on together just a couple weeks ago. I think his website lists like 16 books just on the Beatles that he's written, plus 20-something nonfiction books and novels. And his Beatles books are included in the permanent collection of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's Library and Archives. Not too shabby.
No.
His newest book is the long-awaited and absolutely... His newest book is the long-awaited and absolutely fantastic Living the Beatles Legend, The Untold Story of Mal Evans, which came out in November, and he's going to be doing some more Mal material coming up in the new year. He's also a professor of English and popular music at Monmouth University when he's not writing all these darn books, and he's been here once before, and we're stoked to have him back. Let's get into it, y'all. Please welcome back the one and only Ken Womack. Ken, welcome back to Rank of the Beatles. How's it going, my bud?
So glad to be back with you guys. I'm ready to rank.
10% of all proceeds for Ready to Rank shirts go to Ken Womack.
Man. I think we need like a little, like, you need to like do a little recording so we can be like those like cheesy DJs. And it's like, Ready to Rank. And you can just like hit it every time we start an episode.
Yes.
Like with a heavy, gravelly voice.
Yeah.
Ready to rank.
Y'all do that so much better than me.
Well, it's good to see you, man. We got to spend a little time together a few weeks ago on Producing the Beatles, talking about Now and Then. And I've kind of been wondering, just because I've been seeing a lot of kind of follow-up discussions about the song now that it's been out for a bit, and it had a fairly, I would say, expected kind of exit from the charts, as it were, at least here in America. But I think it's interesting to see kind of how it's growing with everybody. Now that you've spent some time with it, how is it kind of growing for you or sitting with you as you've had it, you know, had it in your brain for a little bit now?
I like it a lot. I still enjoy the song. Of course, you've probably seen these bootleg mixes circulating. I like the, not that I don't like the Beatles' voices, because obviously we all do or we wouldn't be here, but I really enjoy the instrumental version where you can really pick up on that great violin score.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm still enjoying it. Not surprisingly, we've watched it morph into, you know, all sorts of wishful thinking about, you know, what might have been for Lennon and McCartney. And as expected, it gets kind of schmaltzy at times.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to see, you know, I do feel like it's kind of ushered in a newer generation of fans who I think are really excited to have something, you know, new, and that's of their time to sink their teeth into. And I think that's only a good thing as far as kind of extending the legacy of this band.
Well, I don't know if the band will ever need help doing that. I think as long as there's music, people are going to be interested in the Beatles. And, Brian Epstein was right when he predicted it in 65. And of course, they hadn't done anything yet, really, you know, by the standards of what the Beatles would create. And, I don't know if they'll need the help, but it's really cool to see all the TikTokers and folks coming out for the song in such a big way.
Yeah, for sure. And how are you? How are you enjoying the red and blue mixes? Any thoughts about those? Because those have seemed to be quite
divisive.
To,
you know, some of them kind of perplex me. I really liked "I Am the Walrus" at first, but now it just bothers me the way the effects are toward the end. Mm-hmm. Others just mesmerize me. You know, the separation of the violins and the celli, etc. You know, on some of the orchestral versions. I mean, others like "You Can't Do That." That's my standard right now. I mean, yeah. In fact, I literally went on a playlist today I keep of favorite songs. I deleted the 2009 mix and imported the new Red Album mix.
Nice.
You know, it's just a whole new ballgame. And there are lots of songs like that. So what it shows us is just how much technology can do when resourced in the right way, you know, to take an art object and really bring it to life.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Especially on that song, which that was eye opening to hear what's going on in that song. Cause I've always really loved that song and thought the individual performances were incredible. But then when you really hear what Paul's doing on bass on that song is just borderline, you know, prog insanity.
Sure. And you know, it's, people are noticing things that were always there. You know, like the, you know, the background percussion on A Hard Day's Night,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, the bongos, et cetera. And, it was kind of surprising to me to see on Reddit when people would say, "I didn't know that was there." And I guess I did because I first heard it on record.
Yeah.
And I can't believe I'm saying like an old person thing, but. obviously none of the three of us are first generation fans, but I first heard it on record, and, you know, on record, you know, the fidelity was different and I could hear those drums and percussion out of my different speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a fun return to that sound.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I keep, not that I necessarily think like agree with this line of thought, but I find a really interesting idea is like, are these remixes like even necessary? And I hate, and I'm not poo-pooing anything. I'm not picking a side in it. If I pick a side, I'm all for it. But just cause I'm like, you know, give me more content. Great. But you know, is this necessary? Are they necessary to keep the band in the zeitgeist?
Probably not. You know, I've been privileged to go to Giles Martin's lectures up here in the city with the various remixes when they come out. And his stance is very important. It's, you know, remixes are interesting as long as when people hear them, they are hearing the original track and we're not mucking with anything. Mm-hmm. And that's largely been true, right? But there are examples where you can clearly hear mucking. Like going way back to the Sgt. Pepper in 2017, you know, the movement across the sound spectrum of the opening of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which I think is a lot of fun, you know, but isn't the original experience anybody had with that record, by any stretch, or I Want You, She's So Heavy. And actually I do have a frustration with the Blue album, I'm glad that they added I Want You. I think it's perfect, brilliant. But it's problematic in the sense that Giles and or his team smoothed out that one moment where the needle goes into the red, when John's screaming. And my objection to that, and I told Giles this, is my problem with that is that you've taken the one element, and it'd be the kind of thing you can see why people would remove it. If you were a professional sound engineer, you'd say, well, that goes into the red there, bring it back. You know, but John's whole premise for the song is that he's so in love that it's like being, what was the phrase? It's like being lost at sea, and you can't see the land, you know? So, you know, to my mind, you need to have the needle go into the red. So there are moments like that that sort of move songs away from maybe their original intentions. But as you just said about you can't do that, I mean, that's what makes it wonderful, is to be able to hear those instruments disaggregated and be able to tell the difference in the performances, you know, and just realize without losing any of the power of the song, what a damn great band they were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I was once at iHeartRadio for a spot maybe 3 years ago. Oh, God, it was longer than that now. It was for the White Album. And a guy accosted me about how furious he was about this, because he said that these remixes mean that when people go to their favorite streaming service, that the version that comes up will not be the White Album from 1968, but the 2018 White Album. That's an interesting point. You know, I mean, is that problematic that the version of the Red Album and the Blue Album, are they keeping the other ones there? Are they still on iTunes, or have they dismissed them?
But
I haven't looked, frankly. But
even then, I would think most of the versions that are up there are going to be the 80s mixes, at least of the albums that haven't been reapproached, right? Are those not like the CD, like the 80s CD mixes maybe?
In 1980, I would guess. The first Red and the Blue came out on CD in 93.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, because even then, you on know, things like that, you're not getting the vinyl mix of a lot of those things. So
now for the 2009, of course, they went back to the source. So, you know,
that's kind of them saying this is the standard, canonical version. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So I guess those are the ones that are up there, I think. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, but I think you're right that there's some 87 out there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm actually looking up on Apple Music right now. It looks like they still have the 73 Red and Blue. Am I correct in what I'm looking at? And then they have the new 2023. So for now, there's both.
Interesting.
Very nice. Now, of course, you know, did you guys get the Red album years and years ago?
That was actually that was the first Beatles thing I ever got. Was I got the Red and the Blue for Christmas one year, on cassette.
Yeah, I got the Red on record. I had the Blue on cassette, and the Red, of course, still had the James Bond theme. Before Help, and you know, as a young American kid listening to it, I always thought that it came before Help.
Yeah.
But that was just a little goodie you got for enjoying the song Help. I was quite stunned in 1987, you know, that it wasn't there at all.
I had a flashback like that last night. I was looking at my local record store is putting a bunch of stock on eBay, and they have a lot of like 20 Beatles cassettes, like mid-80s Beatles cassettes, and it's all like the weird American covers of like Rubber Soul, but like all the greenery has been just replaced by like a kind of the same kind of goldish brownish cover, like color that the font is in on the US version. And then the logo is totally different. And it's all these weird things of like, oh, I remember that. I remember being confused when I saw that against the CD when I was like 10 years old. It made no sense. Why was it two different covers? And I was like, should I buy these cassettes?
And I said, no.
You gave me a look of like, you idiot. If you bring cassettes in this house.
We don't have a way to play cassettes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you don't.
Yeah.
Although there are interesting collectors out there. One of my favorite people, Chris Carter, collects All Things Must Pass.
Yes.
It's like, and he has every version of the thing ever. So he'll have those cassettes, but he has them from every country.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. Oh man. So yeah, speaking of interesting collections, you've got this new book out about Mal Evans, and you know, his whole thing, you know, his story is one that's been, you know, such a big part of the Beatles collective, but the ins and outs of it, you know, have always been kind of unknown until now, and there's so much, you know, kind of intrigue about what he had in his own collection, and there's been so much excitement about your book coming out, and finally getting that story kind of straight from his mouth. Can you kind of share a little bit about the journey of how that came to be and how you got to be involved with that?
Sure. It was 2000, not 2020. Sorry.
You've been working on this for a long time.
I'd be 23 years. I'd be a mental case, actually. So 2020, beginning of COVID, we're like a few weeks in. And Gary Evans gets in touch with me and he said, "Do you want to tell my dad's story?" And we got on Zoom like we're doing now. And, you know, within minutes I agreed. I said, "I'll do it." You know, I love Mal like anybody else. I'd like to know more about him. And Gary is such a wonderful guy. I mean, you want to do stuff for him. He's just a sweet man. And, and I said to him, you know, "But is it true that you have all this stuff?" And, he said, "Yeah. Oh yeah." And I said, "Well, can I?" You know, he said, "Do you want to see it?" I said, "Yes."
Yes.
And, you know, next thing you know, this big box, that one, arrives from England. And, you know, my wife and I were intrigued. We opened it up because I was thinking, is this really going to be interesting or not? You know, I figured I could get 80,000 words on the guy. And, you know, in minutes, we're seeing all these photos we'd never seen before. And actually that sent me on a mission to get Gary to really review what they had at his house and his mother's house and his sister's house. And I think we found a third more material of photographs and items that were just, you know, completely unknown to the world. And so suddenly we had an organizational problem, but we had COVID. So I had 5 grad students who, when you tell them that there's a project they're working on that's top secret, they're like
in.
Totally into it. They're like, "Oh yeah, okay, that's the project." And then an undergrad who had come here because of our White Album conference in 2018 had gotten in touch with me, and she said, "You know, I want to work on one of your projects. I came here because of the White Album." You know, like she's telling me, "I want to work on it. So tell me what do you have?" And I said, "Well, I've got this thing, and Mal Evans." She said, "Big Mal, that's what I want to work on." So she became our photo expert, and there you go. So we worked on it. I had a team helping to organize it. We've created a data bank with all the materials, all the photos. I mean, it's still being done because there's so much.
Yeah.
You know, it's not finished by any stretch. There are probably still 1,000 photos that need to be organized.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone through everything just to make sure there wasn't something we wanted for book one, but, you know, and it's an enormous amount of material. And, of course it's contemporaneous, which makes it in the world of historical, production is very important because it means that, you know, it is material that was written most closely to the happening of the events, you know? So trying to make sure we have a good handle on when Mal thought something and when he wrote it down also became important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was he a very regular, chronicler? I know, I mean, he obviously kept these journals. Are you finding it was a very regular occurrence for him?
Yes. So the thing about Mal is, and a good example of how he operates is the Get Back docuseries. When he is really busy, right? Because they're working during the day, so he's not hanging out with his family in the morning. He's starting Beatles first thing in the morning. his days were really actually longer. Excuse me, during that period. And consequently, he wasn't writing down things immediately. He would write them down 1, 2, 3 days later, sometimes a week later. There's a bit of a lag, you can tell. Other times when they're not on tour, he's going great guns and he's filling up, you know, his pages. It was, he did all, he also used different media, not in the sense of multimedia, but, and I'm probably using the word incorrectly, but I'll explain. So January 63 is the first of anything. He starts keeping a diary and that goes until late 1974. But sometimes the diary will cease for a while and he'll turn to notebooks. And you can almost time it with when something's happening. Maybe they're going to start a new movie or they're going on the world tour. In fact, when they go on the world tour, Mao goes away from the diaries for about almost 6 or 7 months. And he goes to this blue notebook we have, kind of a long, thin notebook. And that's what he kept. So when he went, when they went to the Far East, when they went to Manila, the last American tour, working on Revolver is in the blue book, the blue notebook. And then he'll go back to the diaries. He gets a new diary in 67, a big one. And now he's back in, you know, he's working on diaries. But there are 3 or 4 notebooks. They're also more journal-esque kind of composition that he does at times. And then he wrote 3 full manuscripts.
Wow.
So, you know, he's actually changing how he records. And then he also, I mean, the absurdity of how much material he left behind, the good absurdity, is that we also have cassettes of him dictating his book. We have, we also have, in addition to the cassettes, we have, trying to remember, we have all the steno books that the stenographer used when he was dictating to her.
Wow. That's bonkers.
It is. Fortunately, she's still alive, and I was able to consult with her about how he worked on that project.
Yeah. Huh. And that was, is that from when he was, when he decided to write a book in 72 or 3, whatever it was?
Well, I think he'd always planned to. He wrote one book in 65. He just didn't publish it.
Oh, wow.
I have no idea why. The Beatles wrote endorsements for it. He worked with a fellow who was essentially shopping it. And unfortunately, he was kind of a one-man shop. He ran it out of the back of his news agency in a small English town. And when he died, he took that story with him. His relatives, I've questioned them. They just have no idea why nothing happened there.
Yeah.
It was kind of his side gig. And he would work with people who either were celebrities or had access to celebrities. And he would do various books. And he had several that you can actually see out in the world. But unfortunately, that one, I can't answer that question. His family has no idea. Anyway, he wrote that one. But then when it came to 75 and Fran Hughes, his girlfriend in L.A., had said, you ought to write a book. You know, Mal didn't know how to write a book, really, other than his previous experience. And so he put together a team, including a woman named Joanne Lennard, who was his stenographer. And I was happy that I was able to figure out their process and then sort of run it by her. And she agreed with my findings. So what they would do is they would sit in their house there. I think it took 20 sessions. Mal would read aloud to her from his notebook. He had what I call the 1975 notebook. Gary found it just a few years ago. And it's really just ideas, you know, and it's everything you'd imagine. Shea Stadium, Sgt. Pepper, you know, Manila nearly got killed, you know, things like that. Joanne, Mal would dictate. She would also record what he said on cassette and do her steno books so that she could then type up everything. So she was making the typescript. Her significant other, a guy named John Hornley, who died in 1991, was the art director at Capitol. And he was out of work. And so Mal, this is so pure Mal, said, why don't you be my art director for the book? So Joanne was the stenographer and John Hornley was the art director. And so John's job essentially was to go through Mal's photos and figure out, you know, what they could use and then how to make transparencies and negatives out of them so that they could send them to Grosset for when it was time to publish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we actually have everything organized like they wanted the photos to be. So when book two comes out, we'll be able to create a pretty good facsimile of what Mal had in mind.
Wow.
Wow. Huh. That's so cool.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
So everything kind of obviously grinds to a halt when he dies. And then everything kind of ends up in storage, right? That's kind of.
Well, sort of. So Mal had finished the book. He had been asked to add in, and he needed to, you can really tell, to bring in stories from his early pre-Beatles years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's if he hadn't, we'd be in real trouble. I was able to dig up a lot of it from his sisters and from his childhood friends and relatives. But Mal left a lot of great detail in that pretty longish section he must have written very late. And Joanne confirms that they kind of went back in and did one last burst there at the end.
Wow. How fortunate.
Oh, it really is. I mean, there's so much detail in his impressions mm-hmm. about his early life that we simply would not know.
Yeah.
And I wanted Mal's voice to really be in his biography. Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to go from beginning to end, thanks to that, with Mal's voice.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about my cold.
That's okay.
You're good.
Yeah, so yeah, things do stop when he dies. Grosset wants to make back their advance. And so they begin a process, intermittent, of contacting Mal's relatives and saying, let's go to press. And Lily, his widow, you know, I'm working for a living now. My kids are on, you know, she's busy mm-hmm. Trying to make ends meet and doesn't have the time for it. Imagine a horrible headache of having a husband who was living abroad die in this spectacularly awful way, living with another woman. You know, I mean, it was probably hard for even to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
To deal with his, you know, the lost ashes, the whole business was just, you know, there's a reason why we dedicated the book to her. And mm-hmm. she was still alive when we did. She did just die a few months ago, but lived a really tough life. In fact, for the last 3 or 4 years, has had dementia.
Mm.
Just a tough, tough life.
Yeah.
But, you know, just a tough story, but it's, you know, a lot of people understand that story, right? Who have situations that are like this, mm-hmm. you know, the more you talk to people, the more you find out that there are a lot of tragedies out there, a lot of skeletons. And anyway, so Grosset spends years doing the wrong thing, which is to try to make good on their investment. I know fiscally it makes sense, but I say the wrong thing because really the right thing was return all the effects to the family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's kind of death 101, mm-hmm. right? You know, there's a class, death 101.
Right.
Anyway, but they don't do that. And the family only sees the material 12 years later when it's about to be thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this wonderful Estonian immigrant who lives a couple of hundred miles to the north here. Who found the material. She was living in Brooklyn at the time and as an artist. And to make ends meet, she would be a temp. You know, we've all been there. I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
And she would temp at, you know, wherever they sent her, wherever the agency sent her. And she had 1 week at Putnam's cleaning out the Grosset and Dunlap archives. That was her job. And her job actually was to throw everything away. And if they thought it was important, maybe they would consider storing it in, of course, New Jersey. It's where the world is stored, right here. enjoy our beaches, visit our scourge. So it
that's a t-shirt right there.
That's a t-shirt. Yeah. I don't know. It's ready to rank is probably above it. Anyway, she finds this material. She's a Beatles fan. She knows it's important. She's really smart. She goes to the New York Public Library that night, looks up Mal Evans and finds out, oh my God, he died 12 years ago. This stuff belongs to his family. And it's just that moment of recognition that Grosset never had. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This stuff belongs to his family. And she took it up the chain there at Putnam's, and they're like, I don't know, maybe throw it away. And then another person said, well, this looks like a legal problem. And then there was like an internal fight. I guess publishing's always been cheap. There was an internal fight inside the publishing house about, well, if we have to move this around, who pays to send these boxes somewhere?
Oh my gosh.
Is it going to be the people in California who signed the deal? Of course, this is 12 years later. Those people don't even work for the company anymore. You know, and in fact, there is no Grosset anymore because they've been purchased by Putnam's. You know, so it's this whole mess of a storyline. And she just can't believe what she's hearing. So Lena is the name of our Estonian immigrant. She goes uptown, leaves a note at the Dakota. You know, and I've been citing Hamilton and describing this lately because immigrants, they get the job done. And she gets the job done. I talked to one of the lawyers who had never understood, one of the Putnam's lawyers, who never understood why he was required to suddenly kick into gear and do all this damn work. Oh. And I said, well, buddy, I can help you out. Here's what happened when you were just sitting in your office minding your own business. So what happened was Yoko got the message loud and clear, did what you would expect she would do at the time, calls up Neil Aspinall. Mm-hmm. Neil said, this, we're bringing Mal's stuff back. This is fantastic. Neil calls the lawyers, Gold, Farrell, and Marks, the venerable New York law firm, who are across the street from the New York Life Building, where all this is happening.
Wow.
And they got it into gear, and they went over and they said, we're here for our stuff. And it was like, it was like Star Wars. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. It was the great lawyering is so wonderful. Because they came over and they said, you know, you will now write a letter. And they said, we will write a letter. And you will say in this letter that this material, you're ceding all the copyright to the Mal Evans family. You know, and they're just following this.
Yeah.
These are, you know, it's fantastic. I have all the correspondence back and forth.
Oh, my gosh.
And the next thing you know, it's FedExed, you know, to the family.
Wow.
And Neil got to, thanks to Yoko, Neil got to help his old friend by getting that material back to the family.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's such an amazing story. Like,
for all of the elements to have lined up, like, for someone to recognize who this stuff belonged to and to, I don't know. I feel like I just would have been like, yeah, I'm going to throw it away and then just like stuff it in a bag and leave
it.
Well,
just imagine if, you know, if they'd called the next person on the list to go do that job who maybe wasn't as thorough as she was and didn't look in every box and just a million other people could have just thrown it in the dumpster and never thought about it.
Because most people would, I would be there thinking, okay, we get rid of all this stuff and the job is done. Got it.
Yeah. Right.
You know, that would have been, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
And she didn't find it the first day. She only had a few days there. She found it like the second or third day.
Wow.
So she moved fast because by the end of the week, she was in the office of a woman at Putnam's who was looking at this like the biggest legal problem in the world. She had actually moved the stuff uptown to her office, the future offices, where all the Grosset was divesting and moving uptown. Mm-hmm. And that's when Lena, I mean, literally on this, I think it was a Saturday when she walked up to the Dakota and left the note.
Wow. God, it really is like a movie. Like, that's like something that you would hear. It just seems like a storyline from a movie. Just something wild like that. That's incredible.
Yeah, David Quantick, who wrote a great book on the White Album, he said the same thing. He goes, when is this movie being made?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally like the opening scene to like the Mal Evans movie.
Struggling artist like, gets a call to go do a temp job.
It's the reverse of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? You know, where the shelves, it's actually coming down
yep.
from that lost morass of material.
That's amazing. God. So the book's been out for a few weeks. You know, reviews have been wonderful. There's another, is it a second volume? Is it an extension? How are you kind of viewing the next one, the next part that comes out?
So it's, the volume will be all of Mal's materials. Mm-hmm. Not all, because there are just too many photographs, but we have 400 photos we're allowed to have for volume two. So that's four times.
Wow.
There'll be more art quality, you mm-hmm. know, full color reproductions, and some of them are just breathtaking. I mean, yeah. Right now there's a small version, for example, of this photo from above of John Lennon that Mal takes around 1967 that looks like a painting. It's just beautiful. Mm. You know, so it'll be wonderful to have those full color, full pages, but then it will also have all of Mal's manuscripts, the diaries, etc. So people can go down their own rabbit holes
yeah.
and lose their minds in the world of Malcolm. In the world of Malcolmy, which is
that.
What Gary Evans is now calling all of this.
That's fantastic. And I'm sure that he's got to be delighted to finally get his dad's kind of side of things out there.
He is. He had the greatest time. We did like a miniature book tour. We went to L.A., to New York, to Cleveland, and some other places in between. And he just had a blast.
Yeah.
You know, meeting people. His sister Julie was there, you know. It was really, really meaningful for him to see how much people loved his dad in person. I mean, he always knew it because the internet speaks loudly about their love of Mal.
Yeah.
But it was great for him.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Well, we've both been reading the book. It's fantastic. You've really done a wonderful job at it, at presenting, you know, a story of real, I think, complex humans. And it's really, really fantastic. So I can't... congratulate you enough on a job well done, and I'm very much looking forward to the next part of it as well.
Well, thanks, you guys. That means a lot.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Is there any? Could you point to anything that you find that you've learned about him, or about even just the Beatles as an entity that has kind of surprised you through all this?
You know, when you've thought about something in an art movement like this for so long, I don't know if anything surprised me, but I'm struck by how much all of this material humanizes their story. You know, it shows you how busy they were. We always knew this, but you really feel the rigor and the trauma of being that busy. You know, it's amazing that they, I guess it's just the energy of youth, right? That allows them to come up with all this great music at the same time all of this other business is going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really quite incredible, especially when you look, you know, when all of this stuff is going down with Klein, and yet they can still make Abbey Road.
Yeah.
You know, or just all the things happening in their lives when they're trying to make Revolver, you know, it's pretty staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also... I like the story because it reminds us that nobody, no matter how ego-centric we may be, does it alone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Dickens did not do it alone. He didn't write that many books without a lot of help from people in your life,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just the truth. We all have and need Mal and Niels, you know, to make our worlds happen.
For sure.
And I think there are some really meaningful lessons about that in Mal's story, but there's also, of course, a cautionary tale
mm-hmm.
about what happens if, you know, you're in love with something and every one of your dreams comes true.
Yeah.
You know, is it too much?
Mm.
And in Mal's case, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Beatles have nothing to do with why Mal summons the forces on his last day on Earth to extinguish him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he lived as Ken Townsend, the great one-time head of Abbey Road, the guy who named Abbey Road Studios when he rebranded it in 1976, said to me, he goes, Mal was like a medieval rogue. And when he first said that to me, and this was also during COVID, I thought, well, that's a cute way to put it. But he really meant medieval rogue. Like, the way he lived was, like, with these big appetites, you know, out there in the world, really doing whatever he pleased in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And recklessly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes you find that with people who kind of get swept up in a proverbial, you know, storm that is not necessarily their storm. You know, like, it's just more than they anticipate, and they're in trying to keep up with it, it just consumes you, you know?
Oh, yes, and it was bigger than all of them. You know, George Harrison said in the 80s, you know, I look back now, and I realize that all of that's bigger than I am. It's, I didn't, in a way, I don't remember doing it, you know, because it's that much separate and larger, you know, than the person I am here in, you know, whatever year it was. Maybe it was, I think, the 90s, actually. I think that the notion of a storm is very important. And what's our good friend in Philadelphia who traveled with him, Larry Kane, told me, he said, you know, when you're on a tour like this, he said, you find yourself living differently very quickly. And you look back and you think, wow, when did I become that guy? I'm not really that guy, but I was while I was on the circus of this tour for 3 months or whatever.
100%.
Wow.
That is an accurate description of living on a tour. Like, I've been through that. You've watched me go through that. You went through it with me. Like, it's very different for everybody that's involved in that. Yeah.
Kevin Harrington said to me that when he stopped touring with Motorhead in like 1985, that it took him years to figure out what he was doing.
Yeah.
That it wasn't, you know, outwardly he was trying to find a job and do the things you have to do to move forward. But inwardly, for several years, 5 or so years, he was in a struggle.
Yeah,
I feel like that's pretty accurate. That's very accurate. This is so weird.
Yeah, I mean, because it's not just, you know, finding a job. It's, you know, you've just lived however many years, and depending, I mean, everyone's role is different. But you know, as a musician, you live with someone telling you what, where to be, and what you're doing most hours of the day, and then when that's gone, that is kind of your mental support network to like operate your life, you know? And when that's gone, or in Mal's case, when like you're the support, you are the support mechanism for four people and their entire empire, basically, when you don't have to hold that, what are you just grasping at stuff? It's like taking the weight off your shoulders and your arms just go crazy. Like, you know, I don't know what I'm doing now. Yeah.
So you're saying we all need prison wardens in a way.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I get it now. Yeah. No, it makes sense.
That's pretty much what it's like being on tour.
Oh, goodness. Yes.
But I think it's good that we've ended up talking about kind of the insanity of the work that they did, because that's a pretty good backdrop for the creation of this week's song. So let's move to that one, y'all. Coming in at number 96 this week is It Won't Be Long.
It won't be long,
Following the success of the Beatles' first singles and debut album, the pressure was on to deliver both a follow-up album and that next big single. On July 1, 1963, the band had recorded that next big single, a song that was written just a few weeks prior called She Loves You. Maybe you've heard of it. This electrifying song features a refrain of Yeah, 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 which Lennon and McCartney had put in their back pocket after touring with Roy Orbison, whose signature song Pretty Woman featured the bridge lyric, Pretty Woman, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. Now, with She Loves You in the can but not yet released, and the need for songs for the next album, Sometime in an early July writing session, John came up with the framework for It Won't Be Long. This song features a similar Yeah Yeah Yeah, but as a call and response form, which the band had also previously utilized in several other original songs. Now, in his 1980 Playboy interview, John claimed the song as wholly his and as an attempt to write a potential single. However, in Paul's Many Years From Now book, he tells author Barry Miles, quote, John mainly sang it, so I expect that it was his original idea, but we both sat down and wrote it together. Paul also made note to call out his and John's satisfaction at the wordplay in the lyric using belong and belong in the same line, which is obviously a game they both seem to enjoy interjecting into their songwriting.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
They're so good at this whole thing.
Oh, my God. Genius.
So when the band was in the EMI studios on July 30th for the second session for their second album, with the idea that It Won't Be Long might end up as a single, it's actually the first Lennon and McCartney original the band start to record for this album. They record 10 takes of the song during the early session of the day, but elect to scrap those 10 takes. The band take a break from EMI at 1:30 to attend a recording session at the BBC and then return to EMI for an evening session that would run from 5 p.m. until 11 p.m. Now, during the latter half of this session, they record another 7 takes of the song before landing on the one that they're happy with. However, they're only really happy with it up until about just the end of the second verse. So they do another 6 takes of just the second half of the song, the final track being an edit of take 17 of the first half, take 21 of the second half. And that actual editing would be done at a later time, so John overdubs his vocal double on each section of the tape separately. Now, the song is released November 22nd, 1963, as the lead-off track on the band's second album in the UK, With the Beatles, and was released in the US in January 64 on the Meet the Beatles album. It was never performed live by the band, though it was mimed, it was never performed live by the band, though it was mimed comically poorly by John on the band's 1964 Ready Steady Go appearance. So, why is It Won't Be Long at 96? I think it was George Martin's idea to open the record with this song, and that's a pretty masterful idea. I can still vividly remember buying the With the Beatles CD, taking it home, unwrapping it, which, if you remember, that used to take like 20 minutes back in the CD days, putting that silver disc out of its case and putting it into the CD player into my room, blissfully unaware of where the volume was on my stereo at the time or what was about to happen. The absolute recoil in my body as John's unadorned vocal just jumped out of the speakers at me while I flailed for the volume knob to try to turn it down. My dad actually came into the room to ask me to turn it down. This song just absolutely attacks the listener from the word go in a way not a lot of songs in the catalog do. I was trying to think of other songs that do something similar, and Can't Buy Me Love comes to mind, but I think what makes the intro on this one so jolting is the vocal starts on the high note of the melody and works its way down when the band lands into the song, whereas on Can't Buy Me Love, that vocal melody kind of goes upward and prepares you for what's happening. So it's a bit different, but still, it just jumps out and catches you right from the word go. I love the call and response thing that's going on here because the vocal melody is on the higher range. It's got the responses especially have this real urgent feel in those vocals from Paul and George, which really fits well in the minor key to major key transitions that they're doing in the chorus. It all just feels really, really exciting and urgent. And the word I keep going back to with the song is urgent. John's vocal performance is just killer. He's got that great vocal grit going on. There's some simple guitar work from George playing a nice little descending riff throughout, and some really cool fast rhythm guitar accents from John that match up with Ringo's drum fill at the end of each verse. And that's just a great little detail that shows how tight and in tune they are musically, and that they're thinking of those little hooks and little things to make things just a little bit more together than they were before on the last record. And then you get this wonderful bridge where the dynamic drops. Paul and George provide this great kind of counter melody and counter vocal under John's part. This is a really neat trick, and it's really interesting because it's done, the vocal is kind of quiet and almost monotonally, and it makes it hard to understand what they're singing, which then makes your ear listen even harder. And by the time you do that, they build it back up to this kind of euphoric, you're coming home part. It's just fantastic. The chord changes in this section are also really, really interesting. It's a progression that doesn't really make a lot of sense musically, but somehow they make it work. And this bridge is so good, you get it twice, which is really an unusual arrangement choice, but it just shows they're already trying new things in that in the world to kind of see what they can do with song structure. Overall, though, I've always felt that this is a fantastic song, certainly a great leadoff track, and it feels like it's still got a lot of that early Beatle songwriting magic with kind of the excitement amped up and a bit more maturity and thought in the melody and chord structure, and it just flat out rocks. It shows the band already growing as writers, but still able to deliver the goods. I'm a big, big fan of this song. Ken, I throw it to you, my friend.
I think I'm maybe a bigger fan. I would rank it higher, but yeah, that's a minor point. I mean, with the Beatles, of course, there's always an embarrassment of riches. And, well, I mean, there just are. And, you know, a lot of this gets shaped by teaching the songs every fall. And I love when we get to It Won't Be Long, because it just explodes for the opening of that album. It almost announces just how far they've gone from Please Please Me, as you suggested. Use the word urgent. I hear energy. I mean, that must have been why they were, as John used to say, the greatest live band in the world when they left Liverpool. Only to slowly, you know, be dismantled by screaming crowds over the next 4 years. But that energy is just staggering. And the whole song is made to me on that guitar lick by Harrison, you know, which calls into question any idea that it's a Lennon-McCartney song, you know, that nobody sang him that lick. He came up with that, that beautiful lick. And it makes the tune, just like the licks do with Please Please Me.
Oh, like, and I Love Her.
That's I mean, just amazing, innovative, inventive bits that George would come up with. It's just fantastic. I mean, it's an explosive tune. And again, it's a barometer of how far they've come since the Please Please Me record, you know, or even She Loves You. I mean, they've shot past that. I mean, as wonderful as She Loves You is, I mean, It Won't Be Long has every element in it. And like you said, that middle eight is dynamite.
Yeah.
You know, and Ringo doing that sort of ride drum part that takes you from A to B. I mean, it's just it's a sizzling tune. You can see why George Martin wanted it to begin the album.
Yeah. It almost feels like something, you know, like when you compare it to She Loves You, which I do have ranked a lot higher than this one, obviously, but as I kind of sit and think about it, like, there's a world where this song is maybe every bit as good.
Sure. And, you know, I get why She Loves You. You know, why it's ranked higher. It's, I mean, it's a signal moment in their career. It is an unabashedly great song. It also teaches really well, you know, in the classroom, because it has a story to it. And it's actually the Beatles speaking directly to the vast legions of female listeners who made them happen, and telling a story that they would really enjoy, where one boy counsels another boy about how to apologize and how to own his misgivings and his failures in that relationship. It's a great little story. You know, it teaches really well. Like, I Saw Her Standing There, or several others.
Yeah.
You know,
For sure.
You know, those great early songs, we owe so much to Jim Mack, Paul's dad, for these, because, you know, he just the way he spent time with Paul, and later Paul and John, and would talk about, you know, music and dance hall and Broadway, right? I mean, these are all Broadway show tunes in the finest sense.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, you can, in fact, we talk about this in class too. When is the moment when you don't feel like you're watching a Broadway show where the cast stops the, you know, the dialogue portions of the play and suddenly break out into song, right? And, you know, and then they stop doing that, and then suddenly there's dialoguing. And the musical is the weirdest of all genres, right? Because it's people stopping in everyday life to gleefully sing or mournfully sing or whatever with an L-Y ending sing. And, you know, there is a moment, right, when they're no longer those tunes. You know, is it as late as Strawberry Fields Forever? You know, when is it? But the way that they exploited that genre, and really the American songbook, right? and made it their own. I know we won't live long enough, even though I keep wanting medical doctors to figure some stuff out, but it will be interesting to see in 100 years how these songs are used, mm-hmm. because they will be, they will always be classics, mm-hmm. and but they're so elastic.
Yeah.
You know, they could be anything you want, mm-hmm. because the sentiment is so baked in about, you know, as you said, it won't be long till I belong to you. I mean, it's like Gershwin.
Yeah.
In fact, it is Gershwin, mm-hmm. and they're going to have such a wonderful life, you know, so many decades or centuries even from now.
Yeah.
That we'll never know about.
Yeah.
And they're the songs are so strong at the end of the day. You know, they can be whatever you want them to be. Like, that's why I think that's why it's almost too easy to cover these songs for artists to just go, oh, well, I'll do a jazz cover of Eleanor Rigby. Well, you can do that because the melody is incredibly strong and there's so much room to play with that. You know, I just did this show where we did, we focused on all 63 stuff, and we were trying to get a handle on Hold Me Tight, which, like, obviously the Beatles had a hard time getting a handle on Hold Me Tight, you know, recording that for Please Please Me and then shelving it and doing it again for With the Beatles. And just for fun, we slowed it down and it got funky on its own. And it was like, wow, this could actually be a really cool funk song. And then our bass player was playing it at home and he was like, you could actually make this a metal song. Like, there's so many things that you can do because it's all just so strong.
You know, there's a great cover of this by Richard Thompson, of Richard and Linda Thompson fame. Mm-hmm. And it is dynamite. He does all these, I think he calls it 100 or 1,000 years of popular music. And he does that. He also does Oops, I Did It Again, which is worth hearing. But his version of It Won't Be Long really captures that energy.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
I can see that. That's cool. Julia, what are you
when
thinking?
When you were talking.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I want to know what she's thinking, too. What
ooh,
do you think?
Oh. Okay, so very silly question. Sorry. Okay. What is the guitar part? Like the iconic
down,
guitar?
Down, 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 down.
Okay, I really thought that was like a bass part. Because is it
sure,
kind of...
it's on the lower strings of the guitar.
Oh, okay, so I'm not totally...
Yeah, that's George lead guitaring. Mm-hmm. It's his lead guitar. It's just such a fantastic lick. Yeah.
It truly is. I definitely have that on my like section, but I have it as the bass part. So well, that.
I think the bass is doubling it, if I'm not mistaken. But he's playing it on the lower bass strings of the guitar.
Okay, so
it's cool.
Okay, thank you. We'll I was like, it. Oh my God, I feel so dumb right
no,
now.
No, it's okay.
Because sometimes it's hard to... tell maybe
yeah, it's okay.
I think my biggest dislike about the song is just like the extremely sad boy lyrics. Like, I honestly, I love a man that's in touch with his emotions. You know this. I'm married to you.
This
you're very
true.
In touch with your emotions. You always have been. I love this about you.
There's a lot of emotion over there.
There's a lot of emotion over there, which is great because I'm mostly dead inside. So he's a good counterpart to me.
Well, we're supposed to, marry people who, you know.
The yin and the yang.
Yes.
Us with, as it is. Yeah, compliment our strengths or lack of strengths.
Exactly. Right. He, over the past 20 years, has taught me how to feel a little. but this is like, is a lot of crying. I'm like, okay, buddy, like dial it back. It's like every line is like, I'm crying all the time. I'm just crying.
Sure.
And I'm crying some more. And I'm like, okay, that's a lot of crying.
Spoken as a person who's never been dumped, which is you.
No, that's not true.
No?
I've been dumped.
No, I feel like you told me one time in an episode that you'd never been dumped.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
To friends, if I said that, I'm sorry. That's not at all true. And I can't imagine I would have said that because it's not true.
You don't seem dumpable, though.
I mean, thank you. I feel the same way.
You are the heartbreaker
you know,
in most relationships.
To your point, we in class, we do a thing, a little game just to keep people talking about musical unity. You know, do the lyrics and the music complement each other in terms of mood? Because there are clearer examples where they don't. Like, There's a Place, you mm-hmm. know, which is this really sad song, and yet it's marching ahead, you know, the whole time. It just is, it's kind of clueless as far as musical unity goes. This one is always fun because you just said it. It's a sad boy song, and yet it is sizzling.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like he's happy that he's so sad.
I mean, he probably was.
You could argue that there's definitely a part of John Lennon that relished in being sad and
miserable.
Angry.
Yeah. I mean, right? So, I don't know. I mean, we've all sort of like sat in our own misery at times in our lives, right? We're just like, fine, I'm going to stew in it. I'm in a mood. I'm going to cry about it. I'm going to stew in it. It's fine.
He definitely does default to being the scorned lover in a lot of songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For yeah. Sure. Sorry, that was stupid.
I loved it. No reply. Yeah, it's a good example.
Yeah. Whoa. I'm standing outside your window and I see the shadow
of
another man.
The 21st century is about a stalker.
That's stalking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's like, that's my biggest issue with the song. That's the part that I don't like about it. Everything else I like. I love that it's like coming in hot right at the top. Like you said, like it was genius to put that first song on the album. Coming in like that is like they're going hard and I'm here for it. The guitar line is amazing. The "you're coming home" lines, like, love it. Like when he just like sort of belts it out, I'm just like, yes, he's super pumped because he's been so sad. Like, please, I'm glad you're gonna feel better. I'm pretty happy for you. I find like the this is such a weird thing in my head, and I'm sorry, and no, I can't explain it. When they sort of do the call and response yes, like when the response comes in, it's like so fast. Like there's no, they don't like take a beat or anything. It's just like, yeah. Like it's so fast. It makes me think like the Muppets should do this.
I could see that.
Yeah. Yes, like I want a Muppets version of this for some reason.
There may be one, actually.
Okay.
For real?
I mean, the Muppets gave us Letter B, which is...
That's true. I think about that all the time. That lives right through my head.
Yeah, you know, those yeah-yeahs are so important because they actually play out the logical progression of the yeahs in the last verse, where it's yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's brilliant. You know, that they'll also do that in Sexy Sadie. In that long organic guitar bit at the end where George finally finishes and hits the high note that they've always been working toward. It's just, it's so damn smart.
Yeah. Like things like that, you know, at that stage in their career, I wonder, you know, is that George Martin making these little bit arrangement ideas, or is that just them like already kind of being, you know, having the intuition to know when to do those things? I tend to think it's them kind of having studied and done their 10,000 hours of, you know, like you talked about, you know, Jim Mack having all this influence on, you know, on Paul's writing, especially, you know, because there are things, you know, John claims this as his own, but that bridge seems like Paul to me. Like that just seems like a Paul bridge just because it's melodically weird and adventurous.
Those 1980 interviews are both a miracle on the one hand that David Sheff made sure we had access to those and asked all those smart questions, you know, tell us about the writing of this and that. Of course, the problem is that he dies at age 40 and he doesn't get a chance to go back and, you know, sift through his memories and think about things. And, you know, it's a heartbreak in a lot of ways, you know,
for sure.
Because it forces him to be almost, well, not almost, it concretizes in time what John thinks about his songs. And of course, then Paul has to come back and react years later, as you said, with Many Years From Now and in other interviews. And which, by the way, is just another great reason why Murder is despicable.
Yeah. All the questions, the unanswered questions that you get.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, at 96, how are we feeling? Is that too high, too low? Would you say it's, if you had to rank it, you said you'd put this one higher. You're a big fan of this one. Where would you ballpark this one, you think?
I've always been a big fan of it, but, you know, again.
Embarrassment of riches.
You're the one, it's embarrassment of riches. And look, you're the one thinking about these. You guys are thinking about these in a more longitudinal way. I'm spitballing and saying I think it should be higher. I mean, in my world, it's like in the 60s, maybe even in the 50s.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I think of all the titles that have to go ahead of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty staggering,
yeah,
the number of songs that have to go ahead of it. But that's the great thing about the Beatles, and that's why we're talking about them 50, 60 years later now, because, you know, it's like Shakespeare. There is something for everybody. You know, you may hate The Merchant of Venice, but I can go all day about it. In fact, I've memorized it, you know. And I mean, that they are. I had a great talk with our friend Mark Lewison about this once, about are they Shakespeare? He kind of was disagreeing because he's insightful and smart in his own way. But I do think that it's kind of like Shakespeare in the sense that it has so many characters, right? There are all these characters and worlds that they take you to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just nothing else like it. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe higher, but, you know, that's the beauty of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Right?
Newsflash.
Everyone sees those worlds differently,
too. They have a lot of good songs.
Yeah. Turns out they were good at that.
Turns out they have a lot of good songs.
Yeah. What you thinking? Ooh, put a bow on it for me.
I know. I'm like, it's hard. I'm trying to think about, like, what we haven't talked about yet, and I know it is vast.
Yeah.
Maybe a little lower, like a little better, mm-hmm, than you ranked it. But I don't know that I can fight you on it too much, because I know there's so much good ahead.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many songs. There's, what number is this?
96.
There's 95 songs we haven't, yeah, talked about yet.
Yeah.
And I would say a lot of those are really, 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 really good.
I would agree. I would tend to agree.
So, this is like the really hard section for me.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Oh.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit better.
Okay. All right. Well, we've done it. We've ranked it, baby.
We've ranked it.
Before we let you go, we normally do the rapid fire questions here. Can you hang on for 30 seconds? I need to go grab
something.
I'll be right back.
Oh my gosh.
I'm ready to be rapid fired. Rabid. Rapid. Not rabid.
Please not rabid.
No rabid.
No rabid.
No. I'm sick, but I'm not sick in that way.
No, please don't be. That would be terrible. Ugh. We actually had like a few years back a raccoon problem, like, and the house behind us has been abandoned since Hurricane Katrina.
And oh my God!
I know, it's still abandoned. Well, it's sort of cleaned up a little bit now. The house behind us and one over there, the woman lives in that house and she owns the one behind us. And someone like gave it to her, like someone died and left it to her, and she hasn't done anything with it. And so it was sort of like open for a while, and these raccoons just took up residence, and they would like come across the fence and come after our dogs.
Here?
Oh, because he was.
Did you Google my name
rabid.
And find the raccoon
no.
story? Okay.
He was stuck. He said. He said rabid instead of rapid. And so I was telling him the raccoon story, our crazy raccoon story.
Yeah, if you Google my name and raccoons, you'll find the time I got bit by a raccoon and ended up on the news.
Was it one of the neighbor raccoons?
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. It, like, they came across the fence and came after our dogs. And he tried to, like, kick it off of one of the dogs. It was, like, biting the dog. And then it bit him, like, through his jeans. So he had to go to the emergency room. How many shots did you have to get? It was, like, 20-something.
Oh, God.
Like, that night it was, like, 14.
It was
and then
14,
you had to go back. It was a
and
mess.
And then I went back for, I think, 2 shots every other week for, like, 2 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I gave our city council person an earful. After that, and then they had sent code enforcement out to deal with it. So, but I was like, it takes my husband being bit by a raccoon for you to do something about this mess. Like, I've been messaging you for months. I was very upset.
Yeah,
but you're fine. Good news.
Rabies free
Rabies
since 2018.
All
right. So we normally do the rapid fire questions. However, I couldn't really think of any good ones since we did kind of the standard ones with you last time. So I want to play a little game that we like to call Beatles Trivia.
Oh, gosh.
And I only want to play this because I feel like you know your stuff. So I'm going to give you, like, some of the tricky ones. You feel like you can do this?
Right, and if I can't, I don't mind embarrassing myself.
There are no prizes to be won. It's just pride. All right.
Pride.
Which
pride can hurt you, too.
Well done. Well done. All right. We're going to stick with the Beatles album here. Let's see. Which girl group's recording of Devil in His Heart was covered by the Beatles as Devil in Her Heart?
Oh, my God.
You're so mean.
Is it the Crystals?
Not the Crystals.
Who is it? Tell me.
The Donnays? The Donnays?
The Donnays, yeah.
You don't even know how to say it. You can't ask the question you don't even know the answer to.
Valid.
Jonathan.
Yeah, we all blew that.
Shame on you.
We all did. Sorry about that.
You should cut that.
And you know what? That, by the way, points out I should know my girl groups better.
Well, there's so many of them.
You got the Cookies and the Donnays.
Yeah. There's so many, though. But they're all good.
Yeah, that's true. But
they're good.
Yeah. But they're so important to the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
What instrument did George Martin overdub on Baby It's You?
Was that the Celesta?
Yes. Ding, ding, ding.
Okay, that's a little bit of redemption.
Redemption,
there.
Redemption. All right, three more.
I think it's just because I like to say that the word Celesta.
I always say it wrong and just say Celeste because that's our cousin's name, but that's not the right.
I think that, yeah, and it's also a name from, of course, the important series, Babar.
Ooh.
Aww.
I haven't thought about Babar in forever.
That's why I'm here, buddy.
Just little bits of nostalgia.
Let's see. Let's jump to Abbey Road here. In the song...
Oh, thank God. No girl groups.
In the song Maxwell's Silver Hammer, who are Maxwell's first and last victims?
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to ask me about pataphysics, and I was going to go on all day about philosophy. I don't know. What?
Joan and the judge at Maxwell's trial.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
That is tough.
We'll do one more. One more.
Okay, good. I hope this is my other redemptive question. I need it.
I think you can do it. In what song did the Beatles blow through combs covered with toilet paper?
That's Lovely Rita.
You got it. Ding dong. Ding dong.
Those are
so I
kind of
know the recording stuff. Right. And yeah.
Oh, oh man.
Goodness. Those are too hard.
Now, wait, is that the Beatles trivia game?
100%. 100%.
I used to have such a handle on those. I knew them all, but that was in my younger days.
Oh, my gosh.
We played it with some friends this was a few years ago. And God, the one question about what was the name of the plane that the Beatles came to America on?
Jet Clipper Defiance.
It's like, how is this a real question?
Yeah, it stuck in my head because it was
I'll
so
never
ridiculous.
Forget, though. Jet Clipper Defiance. Yeah. Well.
Yeah, and they call them Pan Am Clippers.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes it sound like some fancy schooner. You know.
Schooner is a sailboat. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, living the Beatles legend.
I mean, that's fantastic trivia right there.
Well, Living the Beatles Legend is out now. It's fantastic. Where can everyone get a copy of it that's most beneficial to you and not Jeff Bezos?
Anywhere they go is good for me.
Yeah.
You know, whatever their favorite bookseller is. Right now, it's in a lot of bookstores. So, you know, support your local bookstores.
Awesome.
You know, whether it's Barnes & Noble or Fred's Books or, you know.
Yeah.
Jason always tells me at a bookstore you guys have. What's the one that he loves?
Octavia Books.
Yep, that's it.
Yep. That's the one.
Yeah, you know, support your local bookstores, but Amazon gets the job done.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Or your local library.
Or
support
go to your
local library.
Yeah.
We love libraries. Libraries are fantastic. I mean, it doesn't financially support you quite as much, I'm sure, but you
that's
know.
Okay. I have a day job of which I'm very proud and devoted.
Yeah.
So. No worries.
Do you have any upcoming courses, virtual courses?
Well, we're in the last week now. On Monday, we do Abbey Road. We're closing it down. That's a rough one.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of emotion packed in to that last class. We just did the Get Back project. We watched the entire rooftop concert, by the way.
Oh, nice.
We had a good time.
Wish I got to do that in school and get credit for
it. Yeah.
I just failed things.
Next semester, I'm doing Bruce Springsteen.
All right. Nice. Okay.
Same thing, soup to nuts.
Yeah.
Very excited.
Nice.
These are just, it's a privilege to be able to tell those stories and to, you know, to experience all those great songs again.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And when does the second volume of Mal Evans goodness come out?
Could be November. It's going to depend a lot on the press. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an art heavy book.
Yeah.
I really want it to be ready so that we could have it available 1 year later. But, you know, this is an art book and, it's going to be oversized, you know, so it'll be, because it should be something, in some cases, it'll be the actual size of the diaries, some of the pages.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
You know, like the Sergeant Pepper year, 67, you know, or he had these big pages he was working on. So, I'm thrilled about it. I really cannot wait for people to go and have their own Mal Evans stories and run down their own mysteries and follow the names and the places and everything and probably find out, you know, things they will find things that we never imagined. That'll be wonderful.
Wow. Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited.
I'm so excited for you and for his family.
Yeah.
That they get to have this concrete celebration of him.
It's been very cathartic for Gary and Julie. Gary went to my two classes while he was here. He went to Magical Mystery Tour and Sergeant Pepper.
Oh, cool.
Because we had our Mondays off when we'd fly back into Jersey so I could teach the Beatles. And Gary came to class. In fact, Gary and Julie came to the Magical Mystery Tour class. And at the end of that section, because the White Album is so long, we talk about the big change that's coming, which are those February sessions, right? Lady Madonna, Across the Universe, Hey Bulldog. Mm-hmm. That really kicked this new phase into gear. And, you know, Gary grew up with these guys, and he listened to Across the Universe. So we're listening to the John and the acoustic guitar, right? No overdubs, nothing, just that perfect, beautiful, mellifluous sound. And Gary just had to get up, and he had to go out in the hallway and cry for a while.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, it was, and I said to the students in the next class, I said, I hope you noticed the real emotion. Mm-hmm. That he was experienced. I mean, he was a 6-year-old, you know, a 7-year-old when John was doing that.
Yeah.
This is a guy who he grew up with. You know, he swam in his pool and, mm-hmm. you know, hung out with him in his various houses. That just brings it home how real this is. It's not some far-flung place. Real emotions in a real world.
Yeah. They're humans. It's so easy to forget that.
It was really powerful. And there were several moments like that that were quite cathartic.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic.
I'm so happy for them.
Yeah. Well, Ken, thank you, man. It's been a pleasure to get to catch up with you. And everybody go pick up a copy of the book and look for the new one next year. And I look forward to seeing you in February at the Fest.
Outstanding. And as you know, I'm always happy to come back because I'm always ready to rank.
I'm going to use that as like a little bumper. Fantastic. Ken Womack, everybody. The Woe. I don't think anyone calls him that. I don't know. Maybe they do. I should have asked. Do they call you the Woe?
He's never coming back. He's going to listen to this and be like,
God damn it.
These idiots.
Oh, man.
This one thinks it's a bass. This one's giving me crappy nicknames. I'm out.
Raccoon face over here. That was a lot of fun, though. I really enjoyed talking about Mal with him. The book is fantastic. Mm-hmm. We've both been reading it. It's really, really good. Highly recommended, y'all. Go out and grab yourselves a copy. Living the Beatles Legend is the name of the book. It's great. And I can't wait for the second volume. It's not the second volume, but the second Mal book coming out next year. That's going to be incredible.
I can't wait to see the photos.
I know. I know it's on my Christmas list for next year.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Friends, what do you all think about It Won't Be Long at number 96? Are we too high? Are we too low? Or just like old Baby Bear's porridge? Is it?
Just right.
One more time with feeling.
Just right.
Oh, come on. Are you
just right?
There it is. That's what I was looking for. You talked about how I taught you how to feel. You got to give some feeling on it.
Sometimes. Don't make me feel a lot.
All right. Well, let us know what y'all think, friends, wherever you are following us on whatever social media platform. If you're looking for us, you can find us on Facebook at
Ranking the Beatles.
You can find us on Instagram at
Ranking the Beatles.
And you can find us on Twitter at
Ranking Beatles.
Yeah, that's right. Be sure to check out rankingthebeatles.com. Grab yourself a shirt or a sweatshirt because it's that time of the year. It's chilly, so bundle up with your favorite podcast on a sweatshirt.
I like it.
Yeah. And tell a friend what we're doing here. We've had a lot of new listeners this year, and we're very honored and humbled that you are all here on this journey with us.
Welcome, friends.
We would love to have more friends. So tell your friends, new friends. And yeah, we got one more episode this year, guys. One more. Oh, my goodness. And then 2023 is in the bag. So we will see you guys next week with one more episode for the year. Until then, I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
This has been Ranking the Beatles. Adios.
Bye, y'all.